The North Carolina Reading Service presents to its audience of blind and print-impaired listeners the following program. I'm John Federson, and that program is The Indie Week, The Independent, the weekly journal of the Triangle and beyond. And this week's issue is dated July 25 of 2024. And I can present this little closing announcement right now as an early bonus. And that is to say, after the broadcast on Friday evening, the 25th, it's available as a podcast. Just visit the podcast section of the website and you'll find Independent. Okay, here we go with this week's issue. All right, well, Indie Week doesn't get up that often to the town of Wake Forest, but here's a fairly long article that just hit the stands today. 68 acres of wild, undeveloped forest located on Harris Road could soon be the site of Wake Forest's next mixed-use subdivision. Church Street Company, a Raleigh-based developer, is under contract to buy the property and put up high-density housing and commercial buildings on about 50 acres. There's high demand for new housing options in this fast-growing town, but the plan has come under fire from environmental advocates and development-averse neighbors alike. Nearly 6,000 people have signed a petition to keep the property wild and undeveloped. At first glance, the forested property across the street from E. Carroll Joyner Park doesn't look like much. The young loblolly pines abutting Harris Road are unremarkable. Go deeper into the woods, though, and pines give way to oaks, elms, hickories, beech, sycamore, sassafras, and dogwoods. Beneath their canopies sprout native ferns and flowering shrubs, newts, thrushes, salamanders, tree frogs, snakes, and box turtles call this forest home. A stream winds through the northern part of the parcel, flanked by a steep bluff and old-growth trees. Local experts call the forest an ecological jewel and some of the highest-value biological lands in the Wake Forest jurisdiction. Church Street plans to preserve about 20 acres as open space, but some neighbors say that's not enough. Wake Forest resident Angela DiPaolo founded the nonprofit Joyner Harris Forest Conservation to advocate preserving the land as is. Others object to the plan for non-environmental reasons. At a public meeting on July 9th, many local residents in attendance told the developers they worried a new subdivision filled with transient renters would overburden their schools, roads, and emergency services. The parcel's fate is now in the hands of the Wake Forest Planning Board, which is reviewing Church Street's proposal to rezone that land for mixed-use development. The Planning Board will send a report to the town's Board of Commissioners, who will make the final decision this fall. If the request is granted, Church Street will move ahead with its high-density housing plan, which involves the creation of some 400 units, about 300 apartments, and about 100 townhouses or cottage homes. If not, the group will build a 40-lot subdivision of single-family homes on the property instead, an alternative that doesn't require rezoning and would not preserve any open space. Wake Forest's planning director declined to comment until the Planning Board completes its report, which is anticipated in September. Members of the Board of Commissioners also declined to comment. Some in the neighborhood would welcome a 40-lot subdivision. At the neighborhood meeting, when a member of Church Street team floated that option to attendance, the room broke out in cheers and applause. George Deloach, a member of the Church Street team, tells Indy in an email, "All we've really ever wanted to do is find a plan the town would approve. Under the current zoning, we can do a subdivision with very expensive homes on large lots. If the rezoning fails, we will just do that. But this doesn't seem to be the best use of the property, he adds. Not from our perspective, not, we believe, from that of the advocates, and not from the town's planners. The current owner agrees that Church's Street's plan to leave about 20 acres of the property undeveloped represents a good compromise, she says. Our family really has been behind a compromise to do something for the town that would be beneficial to everybody. So we're trying to cobble together all the interests, the town plan itself, the interests of the conservation group, and also the neighbors. In 2022, Wake Forest published a new community plan outlining its housing, development, and zoning priorities, which include the creation of a more mixed-use, higher-density housing options. It also calls for, quote, enhanced focus on preserving open space and maintaining a lush tree canopy, and the creation of better public transit options. And the plan is a response to Wake Forest's skyrocketing population. The town has grown from 14,000 people in the year 2000, that's 14,000, to nearly 120,000 today, a 300% increase. The rapid growth calls into question how to accommodate new residents while preserving Wake Forest's small-town character. In 2023, the Board of Commissioners rejected an earlier version of Church Street's development proposal for the Harris Road parcel because it did not align with the community plan. The original proposal called for 226 housing units on the property, a mix of townhouses and single-family homes. So Church Street went back to the drawing board and returned with a proposal for this 400-unit mixed-use subdivision. The group believes will win the commissioner's approval. In revising the plan, the team also made adjustments they hope would appease the neighbors. That's about 20 acres of preserved open space that would include some of the most valuable, ecologically valuable forest, 50-foot forested buffers between the subdivision and the road, and a commitment that buildings would be a maximum of 3 stories tall and not rise above the tree line. Local environmental advocates say the Church Street's updated plan for Harris Road property doesn't go far enough to protect the site's unique habitats and natural features. They would prefer the town purchase it and designate it as a nature preserve or a park. DiPaolo, who founded the Joyner Harris Forest Conservation, says she met with town officials and asked them to apply for grant funding to do just that. DiPaolo says, they basically told us they didn't have the money to match the grant funding. So we're hoping, with continued community pressure, maybe they'll be able to come up with that. DiPaolo also approached the Durham-based Triangle Land Conservancy, a nonprofit, to see if it might be able to help the town purchase the land. TLC was interested, but unable to find a partner in either town or the current landowner, Pate. Lee Ann Hammerbacker, TLC's Director of Land Protection and Stewardship, says TLC offered to work with the town and landowner to raise funds to try to purchase the entire tract, or at least 40 acres of the highest quality land. TLC would have used town funding to leverage county, state, and private funds to preserve the highest quality areas. Unfortunately, the town did not have a dedicated source of funds at the time to support the conservation project. Hammerbacker estimates the property is worth between $6 and $7 million. Deloche declined to share the terms of Church Street's contract with Pate. Joyner Harris Forest Conservation also met with Church Street and urged them to preserve as much of the forest as possible, suggesting they develop only 20 acres of the least ecologically rich parts of the parcel. John C. Serrat, a member of Joyner Harris Forest Conservation team, says Church Street's second draft of its rezoning proposal is disappointing. 50-foot forested buffers to block the subdivision from the road is not a lot, Serrat says. If you're not at the height of summer, you're still going to see straight through. And that doesn't further do anything to protect the wildlife or the native plant species that are there that are going to be going through 2 to 3 years of construction, noise, and disruption. Surratt characterizes Church Street's decision to preserve the bluff and wetlands area on the north side of the property as a, quote, false olive branch, since the area has uneven terrain and would be difficult to develop. She says, you're claiming to be working with the town and to have environmental preservation in mind, but really what you're doing, giving us, is an area that isn't ideal for you either. Deloge defends Church Street's plan for Harris Road. We can't preserve all the property, but we believe that our proposed preservation efforts are generous. He writes, we are protecting the portion of the property that our own environmental consultants and local advocates say is the most critical. The one thing that seems to unite all the folks who are opposed is their preference that the site not be developed at all, Deloge adds. But that is not an option. Okay, well, most of the current issue of Indie Week is devoted to pets in various forms and formats. But before we get to the many pet-related articles, I have at least one other news article from Durham, which says that employees at an upscale restaurant quit en masse after the owner used a racial slur. Plum Southern Kitchen and Bar has been closed since the beginning of July. A social media post attributes the closure to standard summer break. But former employees of the upscale Durham restaurant tell a different story. According to 8 former Plum employees, all of whom worked there until a few weeks ago, Plum owner Lisa Callahan, who is white, used the N-word multiple times in May. These employees say the restaurant was closed at the time and that they were playing the song Euphoria by Kendrick Lamar while preparing for dinner service. Callahan then appeared upset and expressed discomfort with the song's use of the N-word, and in the course of doing so, used the word herself. The employees, most of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity, say that later in June, Callahan fired a black bartender who had criticized her usage of the slur. Callahan confirmed she used the slur when reached for comment and described the song lyrics as, quote, explicitly offensive. She didn't respond to inquiries about the termination of the black employee. She wrote Indy in an email, I reiterated the offensive lyrics in explaining the discomfort or offense the words could cause others in our space. I believe it was a mistake to repeat the words regardless of my intent, and I'm profoundly sorry that this caused injury or distress to the employees to whom I spoke. When the Indy reached out to the bartender confirmed that she was fired 6 weeks after the incident. Callahan says, told her, quote, you are part of this chapter that I need to close. She says Callahan fired her at the end of a shift on June 24th, waiting till everyone else had clocked out and then handing her an envelope with $700 in it. She goes, this is severance, says the former bartender, who asked the Indy not to use her name due to concerns about being thwarted from future employment opportunities. Then she says, but I also hope that this check, as a sign of good faith, will be enough for you to speak positively about your time here. Callahan also fired Plum's executive chef, Trent Shank, over email when he refused to back her up amid the fallout from the incident, according to former employees. Shank confirmed to Indy that Callahan fired him, but declined to go into detail on the grounds for his termination due to concerns about legal retaliation. An email obtained by Indy that Callahan sent to staff on June 27 alludes, at least in part, to the series of events that these former employees described. Quote, this has been a very difficult period for all of us at Plum, she wrote. My mistake, using a word that deeply offended, has grown tentacles that have stolen the camaraderie that we always had. I deeply regret my mistake. She went on to inform staff that Shank would be leaving the restaurant. She also wrote that Plum would be shutting down temporarily and that, when the restaurant reopened, things would look a bit different. In the past, the restaurant's menu has featured items like hush puppies, shrimp and grits, and cheddar drop biscuits. Going forward, we will be plum, leaving out the southern kitchen and bar, wrote Callahan. We'll still honor our southern food traditions, farmers and producers, but we will be freer to explore. I'm sorry I'm late making this decision, but I hope you welcome the time off. In the wake of the email, the majority of Plum staff, including the chef de cuisine, the sous chef, pastry chef, and more than a dozen servers, bartenders, hosts, line cooks, and dishwashers, have resigned. Only one manager remains on staff. Plum announced on social media on June 28th that the restaurant would be closed July 2 through July 10 for a holiday break. The restaurant remains closed as of the 19th. She wrote in her statement to Indy, "Diversity and inclusivity are core values that I hold and have held throughout my personal and professional life and are priorities in opening my restaurant and staffing my business. My intention is to provide a safe and inclusive environment for employees and guests. Following the unfortunate manner in which I communicated my discomfort with the music, I apologize sincerely, held team meetings, took time away from the restaurant to give the team space to work without my presence, and have been open with my new staff about what transpired," she continued. "I take full responsibility for my words, response, and my continued commitment to a safe and inclusive space for all who walk through our doors." A Charlotte native who spent decades working for a luxury stainless steel cookware company in New York City, Callahan moved from Brooklyn to Durham in 2017 and opened Plum 3 years later. She views her restaurant as, quote, "a mashup of my dreams and desires from a life of eating in restaurants." That was per a biographical statement that was removed from Plum's website recently. Restaurants run in the family. Callahan's brother, Kevin, has owned Carborough's Acme Food and Beverage, also an upscale restaurant serving Southern fare, since 1998. His tenure at the Carborough restaurant has also had turbulence. As Indy Hess reported, in 2022, nearly the entire Acme staff went on a month-long strike to protest allegations of sexual harassment against him. The strike ended 3 months in when demands were not met and the striking staff uniformly quit. Callahan brought Shank, the executive chef, on board at the very beginning. He helped to build Plum's management team, including recruiting his wife, Emma Shank, to be the pastry chef and later the events manager, and his friend Nick Grady to be chef de cuisine, per more blurbs that have been scrubbed from the site. The three attended culinary school together. Former employees say the Shanks played a vital role in building Plum's reputation as a destination for exceptional Southern food and a hot spot for baby showers, wedding receptions, and other events. Former employees also give the Shanks credit for cultivating Plum's day-to-day work environment, which they describe as phenomenal. Every former employee who spoke to Indy, including several who have spent a decade or more in the restaurant industry, said that prior to this incident, Plum was the best place they had ever worked. The former bartender says all the staff got along really, really well. "I've always felt othered in service industry jobs. Plum, at least at first, felt like a really safe and comfortable space for me to be in." Callahan was in the restaurant almost every day, and for the most part, they got along with her. A former bartender says there was never, like, racial tension, and the incident in May came as a shock. It was the week of the Kendrick Drake beef. Kendrick had just released the song Euphoria, and employees were listening to it as they prepped for dinner service. Upon hearing the song, employees say Callahan appeared upset. "I am so sick of hearing nig this, nig that, nig, nig, nig," she said, according to multiple employees present. The former bartender said she switched off the music and the restaurant fell silent. A server asked Callahan if she had just said that N-word. She replied, "Yes, I did. That's what they said in the song," according to several employees. ironically, one of the best-known bars of Euphoria, a song in which Kendrick blacks Drake for co-opting black American culture, says, "I even hate when you say the word nig." Bartender told Indy that she told Callahan it wasn't okay for her to use that word, but that they could unpack this later as the restaurant was about to open. Several minutes before opening, though, Callahan started pestering her with questions about why she couldn't say the slur, even repeating it at one point. She says Callahan confronted her behind the bar, making it impossible for her to exit the conversation, which made her especially uncomfortable. The bartender said Callahan asked us, "Why is it, quote, only okay if one of you says it?" "When you say one of you, do you mean N-word?" the bartender responded, and she said, "Well, yes, I guess so." At that point, I was like, "Listen, I think it's a good idea for you not to speak to me at all right now." Bartender asked Trent Schenck how to proceed. Together with the rest of the employees on that shift, the two of them decided they should ask Callahan to take some time away from the restaurant, an account that Schenck and others confirmed. "My reality," says the bartender, "I need income. It's not a fair compromise because I still have to be in the space where I got traumatized. But I don't have to be around her. That makes things a little better." Callahan told staff she understood and agreed to take 2 weeks away from the restaurant. When she returned, things remained tense, say the former employees. One describes the change as a polar shift. The former bartender describes experiencing microaggressions, like moving her belongings and nitpicking about her work. Quote, "She went out of her way to other me to a point where other people noticed. It was just a hellish month." The only other black person employed at Plum at the time, a host who also asked to remain anonymous because of fears it will affect his future employment, says he also felt like Callahan singled him out when she returned. She would approach him at the host's stand and frequently bring up that racial incident, he says. Nonetheless, all the former staffers say they were hopeful that things could be smoothed over. But a few weeks later, it became clear the situation had become untenable. On June 24, Emma Schenck gave Callahan notice she was resigning, telling the Indy, "I no longer feel comfortable as an employee in that building and working for her." She informed Callahan that she was willing to stay on for another week or so to help with the transition, but Callahan told her that wouldn't be necessary. Later that night, Callahan fired that bartender, and shortly after, Trent Schenck. Numerous staff members say they were outraged, both about the initial racial incident and the firings, and felt they did not want to work at Plum without the Schenck's leadership. Most employees wanted to leave immediately, but Trent Schenck encouraged them to stay a few more days to work an event because he didn't want the people who booked the event to be left out to dry. Staff obliged, and he worked the event for free. Then just after the event, just about everyone left, former employees say. The host says that Callahan offered him $1,000 to stay through the transition, and he declined. He wrote in an email obtained by the Indy to Callahan, "The inner turmoil I've had over the last weeks has caused me to have stress and to have anxiety about coming to work and while at work. I was afraid it would happen to me next, or that I would be fired for standing up for myself. I chose not to talk about it because I live in this skin." Two other employees also told Indy that Callahan offered them money to stay, and they declined. In conversations with Indy, multiple employees use the word heartbroken to describe how they feel about leaving Plum, and they wish Callahan had taken the situation as an opportunity for growth. Trent Schenck declined to comment on the record, but provided a statement that he requested be published in full. "I started this restaurant with one goal I believe in, creating a restaurant where our team feels safe and confident. I had other dreams and aspirations, but I knew if we could create the right culture, we would be able to provide the best hospitality and taste the love in the cooking. Our team had created something you don't see often, and people could tell that Plum was different, and I'm proud of that. My deepest sympathy goes out to my Plum family. both team members and our regulars that were part of our community. I thank you, appreciate you, and love you all. Now, I mentioned this issue, this week's issue of Indie Week, is devoted to pets of various descriptions and types. And there, I have a quartet of articles, and I'm going to put aside a couple of my unread materials from other fields, art and a couple of other things, and read these some of these pet-related articles. And the first, by Sarah Edwards, says, "An Amber Alert for Lost Pets." The idea first came to Clayton Gladue during a frantic night of searching for a lost dog. This was in 2014. Earlier in the evening, a friend of his had let her rescue lab, Ramsey, out of the yard to go to the bathroom. Ramsey got spooked by a car and took off into the dark. "We freaked out," Gladue tells the Indy from his office in Raleigh. "You just don't think it's going to happen to you, and when it does, you don't know what to do, right? It's frantic, and time is of the essence. It's a very overwhelming feeling." "I was on the phone Googling what to do when you lose a pet," he continues. "It was 2 hours of just driving around, looking for her, knocking on doors and calling her name." Ramsey found her way home the next morning, but Gladue, then 24, still felt there had to be a more efficient way to quickly get the word out about a lost pet. He'd wanted to start his own company for a while, he says, but nothing had yet sparked an idea. When Ramsey ran away, it occurred to him that there ought to be a centralized database for pet owners to use if a pet slips loose. Thus, with just one initial $5,000 investment, was born Paw Boost, PawBoost. First named Finding Fido, then changed to Paw Boost due to the ubiquity of Fido pet companies. Effectively, an Amber Alert for lost pets. According to the Animal Humane Society, one out of every three pets will go missing in their lifetime, a figure that comes out to roughly about 10 million lost pets in the United States each year. This estimate will not come as a surprise to anyone who belongs to Next Door or a neighborhood listserv, in which notices of lost pets of all stripes and shades circulate frequently. If an animal is picked up without identifying information or a way to connect with an owner, it will land in a shelter. According to the ASPCA, about 900,000 animals in shelters, 900,000 in shelter animals are euthanized each year. More than half are cats, while nearly 400,000 are dogs. Paw Boost, which now claims to be behind more than 1,700,000 lost pet reunions across the world, functions like an amplified listserv. Users upload a lost pet post, which is then shared to the area's Paw Boost Facebook page, pushed out to the app users, and added to a large database of lost pets. Alerts also go out to local rescue squads, like volunteer groups comprising local shelter employees, veterinarians, and pet lovers. According to the Paw Boost website, as many as over 3 million people are now signed up for notifications in their area. A simple missing post gets streamlined and amplified. Anyone who has either found a lost pet or helped someone else find a lost pet knows how emotional of an experience it is. Pets are family. Sarah Edwards continues, "My own cat and dog both wandered into my life in zigzaggy ways. The dog, Penny, from a Wake Forest rescue, saving Grace. The cat, Juniper, more literally, as a street cat in Brooklyn, consistently jonesing for food and tuna cans. Both have fundamentally altered how I experience the world and other beings in it. On daily walks, seeing how many people's faces light up just coming into the general radius of a dog is one of those sturdy affirmations of humanity that makes life feel both generous and generative." And while I have not followed my conversation, glad you joined a local rescue squad, it by no means feels far-fetched that anyone would choose to spend their time pursuing such reunions. In Raleigh, the Paw Boost Facebook page alone has more than 9,000 followers. Gladue says, there are all these people that are animal lovers that want to help. There's a huge community aspect to it. The avatar for this person is literally my mom. You go on her Facebook and it's all pet photos. Daily Happy Tail updates on the website attest to both the community and its utility. Take the account of Muffin, a steely-eyed white cat who jumped a porch railing in Ken Carroll, Colorado, and was located a mile and a half away by a neighbor. Muffin's owner wrote, I also posted on Facebook next door and Ring. Paw Boost seems to have a longer reach into the community. Or this philandering pug from San Bernardino, California. Silas got out while looking for his girlfriend, the owner wrote. My neighbor saw my missing pet alert on Paw Boost and contacted me almost immediately. Silas is now home safely. For Gladue, who now has around a dozen employees, the bet has paid off. The company is, he says, bootstrapped with no official valuation, but revenue is in the low millions. By way of a bonus, he also gets to see happy updates roll in. According to Gladue, human error, animal curiosity and loud noises, namely fireworks or a loud car, like the one that scared his friend's dog, are most often to blame for a pet getting loose. Collars with name tags help, as do microchips, so long as the registration information is up to date. But nothing replaces a good Samaritan willing to step in and try to get a pet home. Mariana Chambers is one such good Samaritan. While living in Garner several years ago, a super friendly, beautiful dog wandered into her yard, she tells me over the phone, in a gentle southern drawl. Chambers and her family searched for the owner of that dog, whom her kids began to call Goldie, for a month. Eventually, their Paw Boost post made its way to the owner, who had just moved to a new home when the dog took off, unsure of its surroundings. The family had grown attached to the dog, Chambers says, but the saga had a happy ending. They stayed in Goldie's life and became its dog sitters, even keeping the dog over Christmas one year. And Chambers closes the story by saying, it was really a nice story because we got to stay involved. The dog was always really happy to see us and always happy to see its owner when she got back. Well, next from Chloe Boal, IndieWeek writer. Helen Greenberg is an angel of life for raptors. Helen Greenberg estimates that she's rescued about 300 wild raptors in the past 5 years. When a baby owl falls from its nest, when a red-tailed hawk swoops into oncoming traffic, when a black vulture breaks its wing, Greenberg climbs into her Subaru and drives across town to pick it up. She's a volunteer with the American Wildlife Refuge, AWR. That's a Raleigh-based nonprofit that rescues and rehabilitates birds of prey. Sitting across from me in a booth at the Wegmans Burger Bar, her suggestion, Greenberg's silver hair is swept into a low ponytail beneath a denim baseball cap. She wears gold-rimmed eyeglasses and walks with a cane. As she speaks animatedly about raptors, her owl-shaped earrings bounce to and fro. She tells me, in the beginning, I was really afraid of the birds. I mean, they're big, they're aggressive, they're everything you want to stay away from. Back in 2019, she signed up to volunteer with AWR on a whim. A longtime animal lover who keeps parrots at home, the idea of working with raptors piqued her interest. She learned the AWR rescues and rehabs hundreds of hawks, eagles, owls, falcons, kites, and vultures around the triangle each year. They range in size from tiny screech owls that fit in the palm of a hand to majestic bald eagles with 7-foot wingspans. From the largest to the smallest, these carnivorous hunters have evolved hooked beaks, lethal talons, and sharp eyes to track their prey. Most urban dwellers don't spend much time thinking about raptors, with the notable exception of the Internet's favorite raptor, Flacco the Eagle Owl, who managed to survive in New York City for a year after escaping from the Central Park Zoo. But for Greenberg, they've become a passion. After connecting with AWR, she began attending training sessions, practiced holding raptors from the Refuge Birds Sanctuary, then started tagging along for rescues. Now, she laughs, they call me fearless. I don't know why. She's being modest. 2 visits to urgent care for raptor-related injuries in a 5-year span have done nothing to diminish her enthusiasm for working with birds of prey. One of those visits was set in motion when AWR dispatched her to an apartment complex to investigate a black vulture in distress. It had been stranded there a week with a broken wing and needed to see an exotic animal vet. Black vultures are massive. Their wingspans sometimes surpass 5 feet, and they can run up to 20 miles per hour. It took an hour to chase this one down, said Greenberg. Finally, she was able to take hold of its body and feet with her gloved hands, while a woman from the apartment complex held its hooked beak shut. As Greenberg guided the vulture into a crate for transport, the other woman let go too soon. The bird whipped around and latched its beak into Helen's chest, ripping her skin. While he was hanging on, she says, I was trying to put my fingers through his mouth, you know, trying to release him. He wouldn't release. He had to do it in his own time. She shrugs the whole episode off as a pesky occupational hazard. It was my fault. He was scared. He didn't know what was going on and that we were trying to help him. She adds incredulously, everybody hates vultures. They are the cleanest birds we have. Black vultures have no feathers on their face. Why? Because when they go into a carcass, then their face doesn't get all messed up. Their feathers don't get messed up. When the sun comes out, they spread their wings to get rid of all the insects, and they clean. Their stomach is like steel. They can eat all these deadly diseases, and it comes out fine. Greenberg has plenty more stories like this one. She once rescued an injured barred owl from the I-40 median during a downpour, with cars shooting past her in the fast lane. She's rescued huge eagles and tiny baby birds. On the day we met, she warned me she might need to leave as she was on call for the wildlife refuge. Most of the bird injuries Greenberg sees are human-caused and avoidable. 90%, she says, happen when a person throws litter, like an apple core or banana peel, out a car window. A small animal will go to eat the litter, and a raptor will dive for the animal. They don't have peripheral vision, so they don't see the oncoming traffic. Other times, birds get sick from ingesting rat poison or from eating from an animal carcass that's been shot with a lead bullet. Best case scenario, Greenberg or another volunteer will rescue the bird, take it to the vet, and then bring it back to the AWR farm in Clayton to recuperate and eventually be released back into the wild. But sometimes the injury or sickness is untreatable and the bird must be euthanized. Greenberg is pragmatic about this reality. Not every bird can be saved. But she does wish people would stop throwing litter out car windows. When Greenberg tells me the carnivorous predators she works with don't scare her, I somehow believe her. Her cheerful demeanor and natural modesty camouflage a fierceness below the surface. She has a tenacity about her reminiscent of her beloved wild birds. Last year, she was in a head-on collision that sent her to the ER and totaled her car. Undeterred, she bought a new car and has kept on driving, logging hundreds of miles between her home in Durham and the raptor refuge. Months earlier, she had lost her husband, Mark, a fellow animal lover who used to accompany her on rescue missions. He also loved the work, she says. That was the greatest thing in his life. Without him, she has continued volunteering on her own. She's currently on call 7 days a week for the birds. Soon, she plans to get her own rehabilitation permit and build cages in her backyard so she can care for wounded wild birds at home. And she tells me with a big smile, "My job is so awesome. I just can't think of anything else that would be so rewarding as this." All right, so far, dogs, birds. How about cats? Matthew Jankowski has written about cat cafes across the triangle. Spots to sip and pet. Cats and coffee are an inspired pairing. Luckily for Triangle residents, both can be found in a handful of innovative cat cafes from Chapel Hill to Fuquay Varina. These four spots work with rescues and shelters to help their feline residents find permanent homes while providing visitors with an experience they're not soon to forget. When you plan your trip to a cat cafe, make sure to check its website to reserve time in its cat room. Cat cafes rarely allow walk-ins. So we start in Raleigh at 210 Prospect Avenue, the Purr Cup Cat Cafe, P-U-R-R. Purr Cup Cat Cafe. It might be the smallest of these cafes, but it's more than mighty enough to make up for it, especially since the cafe directly partners with Wake County SPCA. Purr Cup boasts an all-vegan menu and seasonal drinks inspired by pop culture references. For example, this summer's matcha brat lemonade drink. If you can't get to Purr Cup for a soy milk latte or a seasonal drink, try looking toward community events like Eliza Pool Park's Really, Really Free Market. Eliza Pool Park's Really, Really Free Market, which features Purr Cup Cafe Coffee. Purr Cup prides itself on its size, offering an intimate environment where you're unlikely to miss out on meeting every cat. You can visit Purr Cup for up to 50 minutes a time with a reservation, which costs you $10 per person. Purr Cup, P-U-R-R, C-U-P, C-U-P. Okay, I'm going to get in trouble. How about Right Meow Cat Cafe on South Main Street in Fuquay? As the youngest of the cafes, only opening last year, you might not expect Right Meow to already have a cast of dedicated regulars. Tucked into a quiet corner of Fuquay Varina, this cozy cafe invites visitors to linger. Right Meow embraces its homey atmosphere, with owners Karen and Damian Posey's entire family contributing to the cafe, from working shifts to creating the cafe's logo. Right Meow's drinks stick out in more than one way, since, as well as offering boba and frappes, their entire menu is named after cats who were former residents, from the frog, a mango pineapple green tea with dragon fruit popping boba, to the Buster, a brown sugar milk tea with a shot of espresso. Right Meow's lobby is decorated with pictures of the cafe's over 126 former residents. And in the cat lounge, you can meet up to 16 adoptable cats, all excited to see if you might be their next home. You can visit Right Meow for up to 45 minutes of a time via reservation that costs $10 per person in Fuquay Varina. Right Meow, M-E-O-W. How about Cat Tales Cat Cafe, West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill? The creation of Cat Tales is a tale of its own. In 2015, owners Katie Poitras and Eileen Spicer met by chance when they were individually looking to create cafes for cats and ended up collaborating on this shared venture. It has a beautiful two-story building with a wall of windows for cats and humans alike to look out onto Chapel Hill's Franklin Street, 431 West. Recently, it became the first and only North Carolina Cat Cafe to create its own non-profit rescue, meaning Poitras and Spicer can follow their residents from rescue to adoption. Alongside the up to 12 cats you can find on the cat floor, Cat Tales Associated Cat Rescue has many other cats in foster listed on their website, waiting or their turn at the cafe. You can visit Cat Tales for up to 1 hour at a time via reservation, which costs $12 per person during the week and $14 on weekends. And finally, in this article, the Frabjous Cafe, F-R-A-B-J-O-U-S, Catfe, C-A-T-F-E, Frabjous Catfe, that's on Capitol Boulevard up in Wake Forest. Whether it be through its Frabjous Book Club or weekly meditation and yoga sessions, Frabjous Catfe creates a sense of community for Wake Forest and its around 5 feline residents. Frabjous has a clear Alice in Wonderland inspiration from the name of its lounge, the Cheshire Lounge, to a menu featuring mainstays like the Mad Mocha, a double espresso drink with steamed milk and chocolate sauce, and seasonal drinks like the Eat Me Latte, featuring white chocolate cupcake and vanilla flavors. Unlike the other cafes, Frabjous offers Monday adult-only nights for those without kids. You can visit Frabjous for 30 to 60 minutes at a time via reservation, which costs $7 to $10 per person during the week or $9 to $12 on weekends. Frabjous Catfe, 12261 Capitol Boulevard on Wake Forest. And again, this article reminds us that reservations are required in advance for all of these visits to these cat cafes. All right, that's enough for about the little meowsers. Let's go back to dogs for our final article from the pet issue of Indie Week. 2 and a half men on being roommates with a dog for a decade. Justin Laidlaw, a regular writer for Indie, has contributed this. My roommate Tom and I have been living together for 11 years, a third of my life. For 10 of these 11 years, we've been co-parenting a dog, or more accurately, parenting and uncling. Tom is responsible for dog food and medical bills. I'm in charge of entertainment and occasionally dog sitting. When Tom and I first became roommates, his dog Mingus, named after the famous jazz bassist Charles Mingus, was living out her last days. Adopting another dog right after she passed was unlikely. Our living situation was already cramped with 4 roommates total, 3 of them musicians. But by the time Tom and I moved into our own house together in 2014, he was ready to be a dog dad again. He contacted a couple on Craigslist with puppies in need of a new home, then made the 50-minute drive to the Walmart parking lot in Zebulon. That's where he met the American Akita pup, the newest member of our emerging found family. Genghis, or Genghis, was insufferably adorable. When he arrived back in Durham, he resembled a stuffed animal toy, fluffy, with big ears and a squeaker box bark. I could almost hold him in the palms of my hand. Teenage Genghis quickly outgrew everything. Our house in East Durham, the narrow U-shaped backyard, our tolerance for his destruction of the kitchen trash can. Tom and I became fast friends, but we were still learning how to be roommates when Genghis joined the fray. Having him in our lives helped defuse some of the more difficult challenges of domestic partnership. Yo, you left the dishes in the sink again. What the hell? Yeah, well, at least I didn't take a crap in the middle of the living room like Genghis. Why aren't you yelling at him? As with any child, Genghis's personality traits are an amalgamation of his guardians. He's inquisitive. He gets that from both Tom and me. He's a total goofball. That's mostly me. He has an unexpectedly high tolerance for the summer heat. That one's definitely me, not Tom. He has many acquaintances, but keeps few friends. That is a Genghis original. He loves his Auntie Eliza, my girlfriend, who brings him mangoes and nearly empty jars of peanut butter as special treats for keeping the house in order. That's all of us, of course. Genghis, now 10 years old, 70 in dog years, is no longer a palm-sized pup. He weighs in at roughly 105 pounds, and when on his hind legs, stands at 5 feet tall. Like a high schooler who hit their growth spurt too fast, he moves with very little self-awareness of how big he is. In the wild, Genghis would be indistinguishable from a small wolf. But around the house, he's just one of the fellas. He enjoys sitting in on Tom's piano jam sessions or watching basketball games, hoping someone will share their evening snack with him as he nudges his way into a position where someone can pet or scratch him, no matter how inconvenient. When it's time for bed, Genghis nests in the hallway between our rooms and the front door to keep a watchful eye out for any nefarious activity on the block. The faintest unfamiliar noise outside, even if he can't see the culprit, sets him off into a booming barrage of barks. At times it's paid off. A few years back, a chorus of panicked howls woke us up to the sights and sounds of SWAT officers preparing to raid the nearby home of a major drug operation. In the morning, Genghis acts as our hotel concierge, sitting at our bedroom doors and scratching until everyone in the house is up and moving. It sounds dutiful until you realize he's just hedging his bets on who will feed him first. Living with Tom and Genghis for most of my adult life has been an adventure I never would have imagined. The three of us have stayed connected through two moves and three precedents. We've supported each other through tough medical procedures. Genghis tore his ACL and suffered a snake bite to the face. Tom fractured his foot. We survived lockdown in 2020. Last fall, Tom and Genghis took a month-long trip out west. The absence of both of them felt strange. Growing up a cat person who is mildly allergic to dog hair, I was skeptical of having a dog around at the beginning. Now, I can't imagine my life without Genghis. There have been ample opportunities to break up the band. A move to a new house, new jobs, changes in our romantic relationships. But our relationship as brothers, as roommates, as a family, has taught me lessons that I will carry forever. Well, I will put off in my folder for Indie Week a story about the Durham Bulls scorekeeper, Chris Ivey, who works behind the stadium walls in a not a mechanized score box, but one that requires moving around cardboard numbers. And it's an interesting story, but this one, as much as I can about Raleigh Public Art Project, is bringing murals to downtown streeteries. For a week last June, multimedia artist Sarah Lynn Calva's hands made careful strokes of various lines and shapes using cans of spray paint as paint splattered on her pants in a chaotic arrangement. She was working on her mural for Virgil's Cocktails and Cochina's Wooden Streetery, an outdoor seating area located outside local businesses. She says, part of my creative process in making murals is that I get really messy, and it's really hard not to get paint on myself. Well, this summer, North Carolina-based artists are bringing these art supplies and beat-the-heat essentials to downtown Raleigh to paint vibrant murals on select wooden streeteries. The painted structures are the latest collection of public art installations downtown. Artists began working on these murals in May, and so far, 6 of 11 have completed them for the Murals on Downtown Streeteries project, a partnership between Raleigh Arts, Office of Special Events, and the Transportation Street Maintenance Team. This project aims to prevent future vandalism of streeteries. Several of these were vandalized with graffiti tags in December of last year, and to take pressure off businesses to maintain them, the City of Raleigh searched for a long-term solution. Rachel Bain, hospitality and nightlife planner for the city, says the businesses received the streetery makeover at no cost. She says, "We've heard, and then Raleigh Arts helped confirm, that sometimes a blank canvas or something like the streetery, a long structure with nothing on it, could be inviting for things like tags, but having a mural in place would deter future behavior." The city opened applications for the project last January, and interested artists had to meet qualifications, such as a minimum of 3 years of professional practice, to be eligible. According to Jen Hales, the city's public art coordinator, 290 artists applied, the most of any public art project the city has undertaken. "It was really difficult. There are so many talented folks," she said. 11 artists were chosen. A selection panel, city staff, and business owners collectively decided on the business artist pairings. Each artist has a week to finish their mural, and $4,800 from the city to cover the cost of designing their mural, materials and supplies, and any additional expenses like travel. Later this summer, two artists will receive larger stipends for the time and materials needed to create longer streetery murals. Hales says the city aims to complete the streetery murals by this fall, and is excited by future projects that will continue to grow downtown's local art scene. Downtown Raleigh's public art allows artists to apply individually or as a team. In June, artists Raymond Henderson and June Vasconcelos created their streetery mural, Love, for Woody's Sports Bar. The pair is based in Greenville, North Carolina, and has painted murals together for approximately a year. This streetery project marks the first time the artists have done a mural outside Pitt County. Well, folks, I'm half a minute short of the end of this article, which I have to stop now. John Feddersen bids you a farewell until, hopefully, I can read the next issue of Indie Week to you, which will be out in a week's time. You can hear this issue after Friday's broadcast on our podcast section. From the North Carolina Reading Service, then, John Feddersen. Whatever my last name is, you'll just have to wait and find out when I announce it next week. Bye-bye from the North Carolina Reading Service.